From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Forgive my nation! Why am I need?
Chevron, just like Shell, uses the military to protect its oil activities.
The policy for all embassies overseas to support American companies and their operations abroad and to, as far as possible, promote American exports.
Don't pollute my water. Don't destroy our mangrove forest. Don't devastate our ecology.
They drill and they kill.
As energy prices go up, we'll look at the true cost of oil. We'll speak with a Nigerian lawyer about Chevron and Shell, an UWA leader about Occidental Petroleum in Colombia, a Gwich'in woman from Alaska about BP Amoco, and an ExxonMobil campaigner. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Former Nebraska Senator Bob Kerry says he's ashamed that as a Navy SEAL, he led a 1969 combat mission during which unarmed Vietnamese women and children were killed. Though a member of Kerry's SEAL unit and a Vietnamese woman who said she witnessed the killings allege the civilians were herded together and massacred, the former Nebraska governor maintains the raid was by and large carried out in self-defense. He said, according to a partial transcript of a 60 Minutes 2 segment, to describe it as an atrocity, I would say, is pretty close to being right, because that's how it felt, and that's why I felt guilt and shame for it. Kerry was later awarded a Bronze Star for the February 25, 1969 raid in the Mekong Delta. The citation says 21 Viet Cong were killed and enemy weapons were captured or destroyed. Kerry's squad, in reporting to military superiors, didn't mention killing civilians. Witnesses and official accounts of the number of dead varies from 13 to more than 20. We're joined on the telephone right now by H. Bruce Franklin. He is author of Vietnam and Other American Fantasies. Can you put the former senator of Nebraska and possible, again, presidential candidate Senator Bob Kerry's admission in context and why you think he's admitting it now?
Well, he's admitting it now for a very obvious reason. And for 32 years, he kept this secret and was treated as a hero with his Bronze Star for killing these civilians. And after 32 years, he suddenly started talking about it exactly 1 week before the New York Times CBS story was due to appear. This story was actually in the making for 2 years, and Newsweek pulled it back in 2001 when it became clear that he wasn't going to be running for president. But this is not the significance is not about an individual. It's about the Vietnam War and really more about our society and our faulty memory about the Vietnam War. This was how we conducted the war against the people of Vietnam. 1 year before this came My Lai, which, for people who don't remember this, was on the opposite end of South Vietnam, where American soldiers went into a village and not only killed about 400 women, children, and old men, but raped most of the women in the village, used the babies for target practice. And eventually, when this was revealed, it was presented as though it was an exception. It wasn't the exception. It was the rule. This was how we conducted the warfare. This was a war against the people. We were an invading army. And it's really interesting to look at Kerry's wild contradictions in what he says about this. And he actually admits, this is a quote from Kerry himself, "Standard operating procedure was to dispose of the people we made contact with. Kill the people we made contact with, or we have to abort the mission. It does not work to merely bind and gag people because they're going to get away." And then he says, then he tries to explain, well, this is really legitimate because this was a free fire zone. Well, free fire zones were sections of the country of Vietnam, South Vietnam, where, according to standard operating procedure, anything that moved was a legitimate target. And this, people have to understand, a lot of people don't know anything about the geography. This is not a raid into some remote foreign country. This occurred, this Kerry incident, in the Mekong Delta, which is right near Saigon. This is supposedly an area that was under the control of the government of Saigon, our allies, who were supposedly there supporting. But it, again, Kerry goes on. He says it was a free fire zone. There were enemy operating in the area. And even though there were civilian casualties, I have every reason to believe they were at the very least sympathetic to the Viet Cong. So in other words, if people were sympathetic to the Viet Cong, that is, if the people were opposed to the U.S. invasion, then that gave us the right to go in and slaughter them. This took place in the middle of the night, a moonless night, while Kerry and his little band of killers was just roaming around the countryside on their mission.
Well, H. Bruce Franklin, I want to thank you very much for being with us again, author of Vietnam and Other American Fantasies. Bob Kerry, a Democrat, served one term as governor of Nebraska, two terms as senator, recently became president of New School University in New York. He told the New York Times Magazine he's not afraid to accept his responsibility for the incident and is under no illusions about the repercussions. He said it's going to be very interesting to see the reaction to the story, and we will certainly follow it up.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. Blood and the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you think that you've heard it before. How governments lie to their people and how nations are driven to war. There are shadows on the faces of the men who fan the flame. Those wars that are fought in places we can't even remember their name. On the radio, talk shows, and TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom and how we come to the aid of a friend. Well, who are these ones we call our friend? These governments killing their own. Or is it the ones who can't take anymore, so they pick up a brick or a gun or a stone? There are lives in the balance. There are people under fire. There are children at the cannons. And there is blood on the wire. There is
blood on the wire. Lives in the Balance by Richie Havens here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Going against the recommendations of the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, President Bush yesterday insisted his administration is committed to opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska to energy exploration, describing the impact as no more than a footprint amongst 19 million acres. He also referred repeatedly to natural gas, presumably because it is cleaner and more efficient when the main energy source of interest to drilling companies is actually oil. He said, "We're talking about a 2,000-acre area that will be accessible by ice roads, and actually which won't exist, obviously, when the ice melts. The technologies are such that I'm confident, and a lot of other people are confident, that we can explore for natural gas in a way that will not harm the environment." The refuge is estimated to hold between 4 and 16 billion barrels of oil. What President Bush failed to mention is that the refuge is not merely a potential source of oil. It's also home to a variety of rare species, including caribou, muskoxen, and more than 135 types of birds. Most importantly, the drilling is fiercely opposed by the Gwich'in, an Athabascan tribe which lives on the edge of the refuge and numbers around 6,000. They say the herd of caribou is their principal source of food and clothing and has become deeply enmeshed in their culture. Today, we'll speak with a Gwich'in representative about the true cost of drilling in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. But the Gwich'in are not the only people opposed to oil drilling. In our roundtable discussion today on the cost of oil, we'll speak with an UWA leader about Occidental Petroleum, a Nigerian activist and lawyer about Chevron and Shell, and we'll speak with a major corporate campaigner against ExxonMobil. That's all coming up. But we'll begin with the Gwich'in activist who's come down from Alaska to tour the United States. Her name is Sarah James, and she is a spokesperson of the Gwich'in Steering Committee in Alaska, joining us from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. This is Sarah James, and Shalak Nainzak Sho Ishi. I said all my relation, I'm grateful to be here to speak for my people, the Gwich'in people, the elders, and for the future generation. We are Caribou people. Everything about Caribou is very important to us because it's our food, it's our dance, it's our songs, it's our prayers. It's who we are. Without the Caribou, we won't be here today. And we're like a Plains Indian was to the buffalo. And every day of our life, the Caribou is very important to us. 75% of our diet is wild meat, and most of it is Caribou. And we don't want to see no gas and oil development within the Caribou calving ground. That's a coastal plain of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or 1002 of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's a birthplace. It's a birthplace for many life form. It's a sacred place to us. We call that place where the life begin. We say, that means where the life began, not only for Gwich'in, but for Caribou and many life form. The plants that grow there, that's highly nutritional for all these animals that are raising their youngs at that one time every year. And any kind of development or technology or activities is not safe for a birthplace, because it's a time for the cow and the calf to be together. It's a nursing ground, and it's a healthy tundra. The ice road they're talking about will melt in the springtime, and most of that will be polluted water that will be seep into the tundra, and there's no way to clean it up, and that's bad for the cow
so
and the calf.
You're here in the United States to tell people here about what's going on in Alaska. Now, what's going on in the Bush administration is very interesting right now. President Bush's comments about saying they're going to go ahead and drill came only days after conflicting statements within his administration. On Sunday, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Christine Todd Whitman, announced that a White House Energy Task Force would not recommend oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. A day later, White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer said that Whitman had been speaking, quote, in confusion. He then directly contradicted her, saying the task force will recommend that oil drilling will be allowed in the refuge. The factions of the Bush administration have issued contradictory statements, but the wall of silence is uniform. The administration has not mentioned that the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is home to, well, as you were describing, the rare species, caribou, etc. What are you doing to enter into this national debate and to let people know here about your culture and your people?
What I'm telling people out there is that this is human rights versus oil, and we're going to be there. We've been there, and we're not leaving. We're here to stay. And what I'm telling them is that it's not going to resolve this energy crisis. There's only they propose only 6 months supply for the nation, and for short time benefit. And that United States only own 20% of the world's oil. We need global cooperation, energy conservation. We need to adopt that as a nation. And this is not going to resolve any of our immediate problem because the oil is not going to flow until about maybe 10 years from now. By that time, we'll have a solution for our crisis right now. We're capable of doing that. We're just jumping at the, something that's immaturely. And I think as a nation, we can do better on energy policy.
Now, the Gwich'in have a very interesting history. At a time when a number of Native American villages were signing away their Aboriginal rights with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in 1971, the Gwich'in of the Arctic Village said you rather keep title to 1.8 million acres of tribal land. The U.S. Supreme Court ultimately ruled against your attempt to impose your own sovereignty over the land by assessing taxes. Is that right?
Yes, we do have sovereignty. We do have tribal rights to the private ownership to that 1.8 million acres of Vinnikin Reserve. It was under IRA, Indian Reorganization Act, but at that land claim settlement back in 1970, they put us into the corporation status, like a Western culture, and which we refuse and dissolve. And once it's dissolved, we put it into simple feet title, and we're the ownership to that land. We own the air and the surface and water and subsurface. And we did that because we're not business entity. We're tribal. We're the indigenous to that land where the creator put us to take care of the land, that part of the world. That's our duty. And we did it well, and we continue to manage our own resource and take care of our own members. And we're continuing to do that. And if we put it, they put us into a Western entity, a business entity, we're just a stockholder, and we don't have any direct contact with a land title, and that will take us away from who we are, and to be the manager.
There was a annual shareholders meeting of BP Amoco in London in the past days. What came of that as groups like Greenpeace accused BP of environmental vandalism in the Alaska Refuge?
Well, they continue to vandalize our resource in Alaska, and it's a short-time benefit. And we need a better energy policy and proceeds to do global cooperation with our energy policy. And for Alaska, we are up there to stay, and we're going to stay, and we're not leaving. We're here to stay, and we want something for our future generation. And with this short-time benefit, it's uncertain for our generation, and we'll continue to stand our ground in a good way like the elder direct us to do. And it's been working for us since 1988 when the Gwich'in Nation took the position, and we're speaking with one voice with no compromising.
We are talking to Sarah James, who is a spokesperson for the Gwich'in Council. We are going to go to a break and then speak with Oronto Douglas from Nigeria, who is traveling with Sarah James. He was just in Los Angeles yesterday for the Chevron shareholders meeting. He, too, in Berkeley right now. Joining us in our New York studio at WBAI, we'll be speaking with an UWA leader about what Occidental Petroleum has been doing in Colombia. And we'll go to the phone to Austin, Texas, to speak with an ExxonMobil campaigner. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman.
Who killed Abiola?
Soldier.
For oil money.
Soldier.
Who killed Arriwa?
Soldier.
For oil money.
Soldier.
Who killed my nation?
Soldier.
For oil money.
Chevron, just like Shell, uses the military to protect its oil activities.
The policy for all embassies overseas to support American companies and their operations abroad and to, as far as possible, promote American exports.
Don't pollute my water. Don't destroy our mangrove forest. Don't devastate our ecology. They drill and they kill.
Everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Some people lost some bread.
And that was Oronto Douglas speaking from Nigeria, the founder of the Environmental Rights Action Organization in the Niger Delta, also on the legal team that defended Ken Sarawiwa, the Ogoni activist who was fighting Shell in his homeland of Ogoni land in the Niger Delta. Ultimately, Ken Sarawiwa was executed along with eight other minority rights activists. Oronto Douglas is now in the United States on a seven U.S. cities tour, climate justice tour, and we welcome you to Democracy Now! Again, having spent time with you and Democracy Now! Producer at the time, Jeremy Scahill, in Nigeria. Welcome, Oronto.
Yeah, good morning, Amy, and good morning, people of conscience in America. I'm here with Copwatch on tour of the cities in the United States. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you with us. Yesterday, you were in Los Angeles at the Chevron Corporation shareholders meeting. What happened there, and what were you calling for?
We went to Los Angeles with Sarah James and Copwatch. I went there because I wanted, one, to solidarize, to empathize, to be able to inform the people of Gwishan, and also perhaps those who have gathered there to celebrate the fantastic profits that they have declared. I'm talking about the Chevron shareholders. And the meeting in Los Angeles was quite curious. One, when we arrived there, there were about 150 to 200 persons in a room, and then the chairman came on. First, the secretary came on, and then later invited the chairman, who came out and reeled out great achievement that Chevron had made around the world and in the United States, and then they eventually declared fantastic profit, which shareholders applauded to the declaration.
Did you get a chance to address the CEO?
Yes. When the resolution was put in place that, look, Chevron should conduct an environmental impact assessment study to determine whether drilling in the Arctic in the Gwishan village was necessary. And Sarah Gwishan came up on behalf of the Gwishan people to explain and demand and request that the drilling should not go ahead because of the impact on the ecology, the impact on the wildlife and the environment, the impact on the people and the culture. I then stood up and then gave an a situation report about what is likely to happen if the drilling is allowed to continue in the Arctic, because what Chevron had done in my community, in villages around the Niger Delta where they operate, what Chevron had done in the region where I come from is not salutary. It's not acceptable. It's unacceptable. And we give example of communities like Opuama, Shekelewu, and other places where Chevron had been operating, where the land had been destroyed. And I appeal to the shareholders, who were mostly people of about 60, 70 years old, who should look at the situation not from a far away place, but a situation where they can stand to say, look, I stand for the environment, I stand for the people, I stand for generation yet unborn and the environment, and so on. But unfortunately, the resolution was defeated by 89% voting for drilling in the Arctic. It was very heart-rending. It was very disappointing. But on reflection, I realized that it is just a tiny few that have gathered there to determine the lives of millions of people around the world, to determine the environment that people, millions of people yet unborn will come to inherit. Just a very tiny, tiny few. And it's rather very unfortunate.
Aronto Douglas, when we went to Nigeria and spent time with you as you took us through some parts of the Niger Delta, we discovered the story that certainly people in the Niger Delta knew, which was the story of Chevron several years ago in May 98, being involved with the killing of two Nigerian villagers who had gone onto a barge to protest environmental devastation of the oil drilling and spilling of the Chevron Corporation. Our listeners who listen regularly to Democracy Now! Are familiar with the documentary Drilling and Killing, of which you are a major feature of that story as you took us on this tour. We did get a chance to speak with the Chevron spokesperson about the killing that day when he admitted for the first time to Democracy Now! That it was the Chevron Corporation that brought in the Nigerian military, which was notorious, like the mobile police, the kill and go. This is what Shola Amole said that day about why, about authorizing the bringing in of the Nigerian military, which ultimately killed the activists.
I guess...
Who took them in?
What's that?
Who took them in?
Who took
them in? On Thursday morning, the mobile police, the Navy.
We did. We, Chevron, did. We took them there.
By how?
Helicopters, yes. We took them in.
Who authorized the call for the military to come in?
That's Chevron's management.
Chevron's management. Now we have an administration which we call the oligarchy of President Bush and Dick Cheney, both oil men, and their national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, who was on the board of Chevron Corporation, actually has a Chevron oil tanker named after her, the Condoleezza Rice. And you have a lawsuit against Chevron Corporation for the killing of those activists as well as others.
Yes, we have. And we are determined to use a legitimate strategy to compel this monstrous transnational corporation to be accountable.
We may have just lost. Are you there? We've just lost you for a moment. And while we... There you are.
Yes, please.
Go ahead. You're saying to be accountable.
Yes. I'm talking about compelling the transnational corporation called Chevron to be accountable, not just to the peoples of the Niger Delta, their environment and generation yet unborn, but also to the peoples of the United States. What we've discovered over the past couple of days on a pollution tour of Richmond and other places is that Chevron is also carrying out activities that are affecting the ordinary peoples of the United States. And what strikes me is that there is a concordance of pollution strategy directed at the powerless, the underprivileged, the voiceless peoples of the world. And it does not matter whether they are in the United States or in Nigeria. What matters to Chevron is profit. What matters to Chevron is power. What matters to Chevron is the dominance of the peoples on planet Earth, regardless of their views, regardless of their position.
Amit Srivastava is sitting with you in the Berkeley studios, climate justice coordinator for CorpWatch. Can you, Amit, put the tour that you are taking Sarah James and Aronto Douglas on around the United States to the Niger Deltas of the United States in context for us?
Yes, Amy. exactly what Aronto said. We are attempting to build these global links between communities that are impacted by the oil industry across the world. And that is why we have Oronto Douglas from Nigeria and Sarah James from Arctic Village in Alaska. Very faraway places, but when you really look at it, there's a lot of similarities that permeate through their struggles, and that is their battle with the oil industry and the oil industry, the oil companies' disregard for their aspirations. One of the things that we have prioritized for this tour is to actually link them with some of the marginalized communities in the United States that are engaged in battles against the oil industry. We are talking now about communities in Norco, Louisiana, in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, known also as the Cancer Alley. We're going to Austin, Texas, where there's a large movement against some of the oil companies, including ExxonMobil. I know you have a guest from there as well, and we will be showing up there. And also, we went to Richmond, California here, where obviously Chevron has one of the largest refineries in place and is impacting a largely African-American community due to its operations. And we believe that we need to develop a very strong multinational response to a very large multinational problem. The oil industry's problems are not local. They're very much global. And they don't just extend to human rights violations and ecological degradation and destruction of communities. It also goes much beyond that. I'm talking about climate change. These handful of oil companies are very largely responsible for promoting climate change or producing the carbon dioxide that is the single largest contributor to global warming. And climate change is an issue that impacts everybody. It's not a matter of whether it's happening or not, as Bush may want to say. It's a matter of when is it going to happen and how soon. It's a very urgent matter. And also we look at this whole notion of climate change and how it impacts certain populations much more than others, how it impacts certain populations disproportionately, something that Oronto Douglas was just talking about as far as the oil industry's impacts. Not only do the oil industry or the oil companies contribute to abusing human rights and ecological degradation around the world, they are also creating huge climate injustices around the world, because marginalized communities have the least resources to deal with climatic changes. And corporations, oil corporations, are at the center of this problem. And it is no surprise, for example, the Bush administration's flip-flop on Kyoto Protocol or even on the greenhouse gas emissions, the pledge he had talked about getting the oil industries to reduce.
Speaking of global climate change and the whole corporate campaign against the Kyoto Protocol, we are also joined on the telephone by Peter Altman from Austin, Texas, who is the national coordinator of Campaign ExxonMobil and chair of the Corporate Campaign Working Group, which is organizing the first national conference to teach corporate campaigning in Dallas on May 27th to 30th, which is right around the time of a shareholders meeting of ExxonMobil. I've been seeing major ads in the newspapers, Peter Altman, by these corporations, like ExxonMobil had a half pager in the New York Times recently about global warming. What is the approach that they're taking right now and that you're taking against them?
Well, the ExxonMobil is taking the approach of continuing to attempt to deny that we know that global warming is happening. They continue to raise questions about the gaps in the science and things that we don't completely understand, and overlook the fact that the overwhelming majority of the science, that is quality science on this subject, says that it is human activity that's warming the globe, and we're headed for big trouble if we don't do something about it. But all of Exxon's profitability is wrapped up not in what will happen to the planet, but what happens to our use of their product of oil and gas. So they are going to great lengths to influence public policy, both here as well as abroad, and they are also engaging in a PR campaign that is intended to sow doubt about whether or not we have a global warming problem. the United States is almost unique in the world for having this perception that the science is, as of yet, undecided on the issue. A lot of people explain claim concern about global warming, but when you get into a room and start talking about it, you've always got a number of people who are sure that it's an issue that just the science isn't certain on. And the fault for that perception lies squarely with the oil companies and with the coal companies. Now, in recent years, some of the oil companies have begun to proclaim their concern with global warming and have started to move what we think is in a positive direction. But ExxonMobil has remained the single loudest voice on this subject, and we think that their track record with Bush, I mean, Exxon was asked by Bush to write a key air pollution policy when he was governor of Texas, and if they continue to have that kind of influence with him as president, it may be a very long time before we see U.S. leadership. And it was just brought up that climate change is something that affects everybody, and it is very much an issue of justice. And I know CorpWatch was key in putting out a document called Climate Justice. And the problem is, all throughout the cycle of oil production, there is blood and suffering and environmental devastation, from the exploration to the drilling to the transportation. But then at the other end, where the oil comes out of our tailpipes and creates global warming, it is the most impoverished countries of the world that are going to experience the impacts of climate change to the fullest degree and which are least capable of dealing
well,
with it.
Peter Altman, can you talk about how you're dealing with it and what exactly a corporate campaign means?
Yeah. A corporate campaign works to compel a corporation to take accountability for its actions. Or in the case of Campaign ExxonMobil, our efforts are geared towards convincing investors that it is in their financial interest to urge ExxonMobil to alter course on this subject. And there are a number of reasons that we think it makes sense to do so. And our working directly with the investors is because ExxonMobil is such a big company and has been fairly inured to public sentiment over time that investors may be a better level to try to get a hold of. So we articulate a number of financial arguments regarding the long-term value of the company, about the financial risk that investors face over the next 10, 20, 50 years due to global warming. So much of the effort is geared toward just outreach and visiting with institutional investors like the California pension funds, like the New York and other public pension funds that have been fairly responsive to these kinds of issues. But I was reminded when Arronto spoke of the Chevron meeting that all they talk about is how much money they're making. This is something we need to remember. The institutional investors that back these multinationals also only have the same thoughts. When you can sit in an hour-long meeting with a major institutional investor, a major bank, and talk about the impact of drilling in the Arctic and the impact of global warming and the suffering that's caused by oil exploration activities in the Nigerian Delta, and all they see is the money, and they don't care about these other issues.
But Peter Altman, yeah. Corporations are fighting back. They are slapping activists with slap suits, charging that they're impugning their name. They're going after websites. So how are you dealing with this?
Well, there are if you get hit with a slap suit or you get attacked by a website, you're in a hard position because the corporation always has more resources to work with than the activists do. One of the things that we're doing to help communities fight back is organizing this conference, Empowering Democracy, which people can learn about at www.empoweringdemocracy.org, which is a 2.5-day skills teaching conference that will help people who are engaged with corporations or feel like they need to engage in a corporate campaign to learn the specific skills that you need. And that includes, what are the legal ramifications? How do you respond to slap suits? That's a workshop I plan to go to since I expect someday to end up in that position. How do you influence the corporate CEO and board members? All of the different kinds of strategies and tactics So on a broader scale, we want to begin on a regular basis providing actual training sessions to activists so that they can learn how to take on corporations and they can learn how to respond to corporate counterattacks.
We are talking about the cost of oil today with a Nigerian activist and lawyer, Aronto Douglas, a Gwich'in activist from Alaska, Sarah James. On the line with us from Dallas is Peter Altman, who is with campaign ExxonMobil and with CorpWatch. We're joined in the Berkeley studio by Amit Srivastava. And when we come back, we'll also be speaking with an UWA leader about the UWA people's battle against Occidental Petroleum. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio as we talk about the cost of oil with people from around the world. Our guests are from Nigeria, from Alaska, from Austin, Texas, from the Bay Area, from San Francisco. And also we're joined by an activist who has just come up from Colombia to join us and talk about his people, the UWA people, and their battle against British Petroleum. In the studio with us here in New York, we're joined by Roberto Perez, president of the UWA Traditional Authority. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Roberto Perez.
Thank you so much.
And let me ask where the UWA territory is in Colombia.
Si nosotros estamos ubicados en cinco departamentos.
Yes, we live in five provinces in Colombia.
El norte de Santander, Santander, Boyacá, Arauca y Casanare.
Those five provinces are Santander, Norte Santander, Boyacá, Arauca y Casanare.
And what is British, what is Occidental Petroleum doing right now in your territory?
Hace 9 años, nosotros conocimos el proyecto que va a realizar sus actividades de la exploración petroleras. Desde ese momento, nosotros fuimos opuestos contra la explotación petroleras en nuestro territorio ancestral.
9 years ago, we began to hear about Occidental Petroleum's project to explore and drill for oil on our ancestral land. Since then, we have adamantly opposed any and all oil exploitation on our ancestral territory.
We have covered Occidental Petroleum extensively, especially around the presidential campaign of Al Gore, whose family holds, it's estimated around $500,000 stock in Occidental Petroleum. The UWA have been taking on Occidental Petroleum for quite a while. And 2 days after the U.S. Congress approved $1.3 billion in mostly military aid to Colombia, the UWA homeland became heavily militarized. Today, thousands of soldiers guard the area around the drilling site. In the past, The UA have threatened mass suicide if Occidental drills. What is happening today?
En nuestro territorio, el año pasado fue militarizado para iniciar la exploración petrolera en denominado Gibraltar 1.
Yes, last year in our territory, the military came in to set the stage for oil exploration at the Gibraltar 1 drill site.
En cuanto al subsidio, pues nosotros, mi jefe, que es la autoridad tradicional, ordenó a nosotros que no siguiera pronunciando a la opinión pública nacional e internacional que ellos estamos manteniendo en reserva, que en vez de hablar de subsidio, vamos a hablar de solidaridad de otros países.
Our traditional authorities, which are the maximum authority for the UWA people, have ordered us not to continue to threaten to commit suicide collectively. Instead, they have oriented us to let the world know, both in Colombia and in the international community, that instead of committing suicide, we are urgently requesting their solidarity.
What does drilling mean in your area? How does it affect the UA?
En la primera fase de perforación, antes de iniciar las actividades de perforación, el Ministerio del Medio Ambiente se otorga la licencia ambiental. Se estudia, que ellos dicen el estudio técnico para iniciar la perforación.
In the first, actually prior to the first phase of drilling, the Minister of the Environment in Colombia granted Occidental Petroleum the environmental license or permission to drill in our territory.
And
how does it affect you?
Pues en caso concreto, Gibraltar 1 está afectando antes de encontrar el petróleo. Se han afectado la contaminación de agua, el calentamiento de la tierra y hay problemas que se han secado agua que nunca en la vida se han presentado esos problemas.
Well, specifically right around the Gibraltar 1 drill site, even before Occidental has found any oil or determined whether there is oil there or not, they have polluted our water, the earth is warming up, and wells that have never dried before now have no water at all.
We were talking about corporate campaigns. Today, there's a protest in New York that you're going to be attending, protesting Sanford Bernstein and Company. Why him? What does, or this corporation, what does it have to do with Occidental Petroleum?
Sí, mire. porque, primero, el gobierno colombiano y la Oxy no se han respetado el territorio de los pueblos indígenas UAS. Se ha atentado contra la vida, contra la cultura y contra el medio ambiente. Por eso hoy estoy aquí para decirle al pueblo estadounidense que la compañía multinacional Oxy está violando los derechos humanos en Colombia.
Well, neither the Colombian government nor Occidental Petroleum respects our territorial rights as UWA people. Instead, they have aggressions against our culture and our life and our environment. So that's why I'm here today in the United States to tell the people that and demand that Occidental desist from violating our rights.
You were last week in Los Angeles, having gotten one of the largest shareholders of Occidental, Fidelity Investment, to divest from Occidental Petroleum to the tune of something like $400 million. Did you attend an Occidental Petroleum shareholders meeting?
Sí, el viernes pasado estuve en la reunión de accionistas que realizan anualmente. Tuve la oportunidad de entrar, pero no me permitió expresar como yo venía pensado hablar.
Yes, last Friday I was in the annual stockholders meetings of Occidental Petroleum. I did enter, but unfortunately I was not allowed to speak and express myself as I had hoped.
Well, let me go back to Oronto Douglas, who is in Berkeley right now, just having come from the Chevron shareholders meeting. As you travel around the country in the United States, you're taking on Chevron. We haven't even spoken about Shell. And I should, by the way, say that we've called all the corporations and asked them to join us today. But each one refused. We were not able to be joined by Chevron, which had a shareholders meeting yesterday. BP, Amoco refused to join us, as well as Occidental Petroleum. But what do you hope to do?
Our hope is to be able to understand the issues better. And we are beginning to understand that pollution and profit does not recognize color or culture. They do not recognize and respect demography or democracy. And there is that urgent need for us to globalize our resistance against the corporation and going around the country, speaking to people, connecting with people of conscience around the whole country. We are hoping that we will be able to build a coalition to resist and resist globally and fiercely and committedly. That is our mission. That is our task right now.
I want to thank everyone for being with us. I want to also be able to get out information to people who is doing what work. Also want to say that ExxonMobil also refused to be on with us today, and to let people know that tomorrow on Democracy Now! We're going to be speaking with Father Dan Berrigan, Father Dan Berrigan, who turns 80 years old, disarmed and dangerous. In fact, last week he was arrested for the umpteenth time protesting at the USS Intrepid, a man who has spent a good portion of the 20th century protesting war and protesting militarization. So we hope people join us for this birthday conversation. But before we go, Kim Foster, who's traveled here with Roberto Perez, is with us to explain the connections, the corporate connections between Occidental Petroleum, Sanford Bernstein, Fidelity.
Hi, yes. Fidelity Investment was one of the largest shareholders of Occidental Petroleum, the largest mutual fund company, and as a result of grassroots pressure all over the world with over 75 demonstrations and a result of consumer pressure, they divested over 60% of their stock. Now we are heading into a campaign against Bernstein Alliance, who is the largest shareholder of Occidental Petroleum. We're asking that people who invest in Sanford Bernstein are now investing in the destruction of Uwa culture and Uwa land. And we are here to tell Sanford Bernstein to stop the project on Uwa land.
And if people want to get in touch with your group, where can they call?
They can actually call Rainforest Action Network. That's 800-989-RAIN. They can also check out the website at www.ran.org, and they can refer you to a local group that's working to support the resistance of the UWA.
And for Sarah James and Oronto Douglas, is your contact Corp Watch?
Yes, please.
Yes, people can check out our website, www.corpwatch.org. CorpWatch, that's CORPWATCH.org, for a complete description of the tour, as well as wonderful interviews both with Sarah and Oronto and other information.
And if people want to call CorpWatch?
They can call at 415-561-6568.
That's 415-561-6568. And finally, going back to Sarah James, who we began with, spokesperson for the Gwich'in Steering Committee in Alaska, since the major focus of the Bush administration is now your area, the ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, as you listen to people from Colombia, from Nigeria, from Austin, from Dallas, Texas, what are your final words?
Across the board with the indigenous people all over the world, our struggle is in balance, and St. Porch's invaders and destruction and destruction to our way of life, and that's across the board. And we've talked in balance. We understand what we're talking about because we're from our homeland where we were born and raised, and our father and grandmother and way back. So we know we're the expert of that part of the world, and we need respect. We need to share among each other about how we can work together, how we can help each other. And that can resolve very simple way, in a good way. And climate change and global warming is real in the north, because we it's real for us as the indigenous people, because we live with the environment.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us for this roundtable discussion on the cost of oil. I also want to let people know that I'll be traveling around this weekend. Tonight at Temple Beth Shalom in New City, New York, I'll be speaking at 7 o'clock. And tomorrow night, I'll be out in Berkeley at the Terrell King Middle School in Berkeley, 7 o'clock. And on Saturday, the Big Project Censored Conference that's taking place at San Francisco State, I'll be speaking at 7 o'clock at McKenna Theater. And I hope to get a chance to speak with listeners around in California, as well as New City, New York. It's always a pleasure to meet you. That does it for the program Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Anthony Sloan, our engineer, from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.